You are listening to Dana's Low Carb for Life. Today we have an interview with Adele Height, some low carbing 101 info, tips on getting the most out of your food budget, and we talk about some listeners' diet challenges. Stick around. You are listening to Dana's Low Carb for Life. Hey gang, welcome to episode 3 of Dana's Low Carb for Life, sponsored by CarbSmart, your smart choice for a low carb lifestyle. On today's show, I interview Adele Height, who worked for years with Dr. Eric Westman, one of the country's top low-carb researchers, and she is now working on, well, 3 degrees. She'll tell you about that. She'll also talk about her experiences in Dr. Westman's clinic and what it's like to be a low-carber studying nutrition in a conservative academic setting. You're going to want to stick around for Adele. She's wonderful. We'll talk a little about some challenges our listeners and readers face to their low-carb lifestyle. And I'll give you a few ideas for getting the most out of your meat dollar. But first, I'd like to address a very common question about carbohydrates. So let's call this segment Low Carbing 101. Now, more than a few times, I have seen or heard, and I'm sure you have too, seen someone assert that carbohydrate that comes from, say, whole grain bread or fruit juice is different from and less damaging than the carbohydrate that comes from cookies or soda pop. People can be very stubborn about this. They are quite certain that somehow this carbohydrate is different. They are, of course, wrong. Glucose is glucose. It is absolutely the same darned stuff. It is chemically identical. Your body has no way to tell a glucose molecule that came from brown rice from a glucose molecule that came from a Twinkie. The brown rice does bring some vitamins along with it, and that's a good thing, but once it's digested and absorbed into your bloodstream, the glucose is precisely the same as the glucose that came from that Twinkie. It will all trigger an insulin release. It will all trigger fat storage. It will all cause all of the problems that come with high insulin levels. Likewise, your body, and especially your poor, poor liver, does not differentiate between a molecule of fructose that came from, say, fresh squeezed apple juice and a molecule of fructose that came from high fructose corn syrup. The fruit juice will, again, have some vitamins in it, but the sugar is chemically identical. Fructose is fructose is fructose. And it will all jack up your triglycerides, trigger fat storage, and, I'm sorry to say, increase your risk of non-alcoholic fatty liver disease and gout. Gout has often been blamed on meat, but it is now pretty clear that the biggest trigger for high uric acid levels and thus gout is fructose. Now, some people will argue that more slowly absorbed carbohydrates, what we call low glycemic index carbohydrates, or I simply sometimes call low impact carbohydrates, are less damaging because they produce a gentler blood sugar curve. And there's, you know, some debate about this. I thought this for quite a while, but now I'm not so sure because I've heard a convincing argument made that the more slowly absorbed carbohydrates simply keep blood sugar elevated longer, and of course that also keeps your insulin levels elevated longer, and that this makes those low impact or low glycemic index carbohydrates even more damaging than the higher glycemic index carbohydrates. By the way, there is also a lot of nonsense going around about which carbohydrates it is that have a low glycemic index, but we will save that for another show. Folks, stop trying to figure out which carbs are good and which are bad. Truly, if you go from eating 350 grams of carb per day from Chips Ahoy and Gatorade to eating only 50 grams of carb per day, but still from the Chips Ahoy and Gatorade, you will lose weight and improve your health simply because you have dramatically reduced the total load of carbohydrate in your diet. Yes, it would be better to get those 50 grams of carbohydrate from salad. No joke. No argument. Yes, it would be better to get those 50 grams of carbohydrate from salad. But the big thing is getting that carb load down. If you stick to a low carbohydrate intake, you will effectively cut out the vast majority of the bad carbs, lower your blood sugar and your insulin levels, and lose weight. Okay, in a few minutes, we're going to be hearing about some of the low-carb challenges our listeners and readers have shared with us. You'll want to keep listening for that. But first, I want to talk a little bit about low-carb cooking and your food dollar. Now, if you're like me and most of the rest of the country, and I understand quite a lot of the rest of the world, your budget is tight. Especially now, right after the holidays, when our Visa cards are all still smoking in our wallets. People often ask about low-carbing on a budget, and there's a common feeling that a low-carb diet is necessarily expensive. I'm going to repeat my often-made assertion here that any food that makes you fat, tired, sick, and hungry would not be cheap if they were giving it away. Still, there are more expensive low-carb foods and less expensive low-carb foods. Now, for most of us, one of the primary foods on our low-carb diets is meat. In modern America, the most popular meats these days are the boneless and often skinless and very tender cuts of meat that can be quickly broiled or sautéed. Chicken breast, sirloin steak, pork loin, stuff like that. These cuts are often glowingly referred to as being fork tender, and they are also often pretty expensive because they are so popular and it's all supply and demand. So, let me give you a very useful piece of knowledge that you can use to improve your menus and lower your costs. When it comes to meat, the boneless, tender cuts are the least flavorful cuts of meat you can get. Indeed, tenderness and flavor in meat are inverse qualities. The more tender a cut of meat is, the less flavor it will have. And the tougher it is, the more flavorful it will be. Why? Because the muscle has been used more. The more an animal has used the body part in question, the more flavorful the meat from that part of the body will be, but also the more connective tissue will have developed. And indeed, that's quite a lot of the reason for the flavor. And that connective tissue can make the meat tough. So the trick is to learn to cook that tougher, more flavorful meat in such a way that that connective tissue softens. And once that happens, it becomes very succulent and very juicy. Once you learn how to do this, you will have tender, moist meat with a rich and wonderful flavor. I personally, as a cook and as a cookbook author, I would far rather have a properly cooked beef chuck than a filet mignon, because frankly, filet mignon is bland and boring. So what can you do to make those tough, bony cuts of meat great eating? Well, there are a few tricks. First of all, you can marinate meat in just about anything acidic, and that will help to tenderize it. Wine, vinegar, lemon or lime juices, all are great for tenderizing marinades. In Middle Eastern cooking, meat is often marinated in yogurt, especially lamb is often marinated in yogurt. And of course, yogurt is also acidic and is wonderful for creating tender meat. Also, folks, meat tenderizer really works. If you haven't tried it, you really should. Don't fear meat tenderizer. It's not some scary chemical. You might want to read the labels to make sure the one you're getting doesn't have a ton of sugar in it. But meat tenderizer is just made from an enzyme from papayas. And it will break down some of the toughness in the meat. Don't just sprinkle the tenderizer on the surface of a steak or a roast. You want to pierce the meat all over with a fork to let the tenderizer down into the meat. Now, I often combine an acidic marinade with some tenderizer. The liquid marinade carries the tenderizer down into the meat. Be aware that it is possible to over-tenderize meat to the point where it becomes mushy. So if you're going to use a meat tenderizer, you don't want to leave it on like overnight, or you're going to end up with a really nasty texture. I find that a few hours is about right when I tenderize a beef chuck roast. Now, you can also simmer meat slowly in an acidic sauce. Again, wine, vinegar, citrus juices are all good for this, and so are tomatoes or tomato sauce. And a bonus to this is if your meat has bones in it, The acidic sauce will also leach some of the calcium out of the bones into the sauce, where you will get highly bioavailable calcium. Very good stuff. Keep in mind that meat tenderizer does not work anymore once it's been heated. So, in other words, you can't put the tenderizer into the sauce you're going to simmer in and expect it to tenderize your meat. It won't. The heat will destroy the enzyme. But you can tenderize the meat first and then simmer it in the sauce. That'll work. If by the way, you have a busy life, it's not a bad idea to put the meat tenderizer and the marinade on, put it in the fridge, and then go out and run your errands for a couple of hours, and you can come back and cook your meat. Long, slow, moist cooking is what's going to bring out the best in a lot of these tough cuts of meat. Although, I have marinated and tenderized a chuck roast to the point where I can cook it on the grill and have it be better than any ribeye or sirloin I ever cooked. But the long, slow, moist cooking is a great thing, and indeed, the idea for this segment for the show came to me because I've been working on slow cooker recipes, as the blog readers and the Facebook fans know. And so I've been doing a lot of this long, slow, moist cooking. Well, lamb shanks, pork neck bones, turkey drumsticks, beef chuck, these are all the sorts of tough, bony, and generally cheap cuts of meat that are best for slow cooking. If you put a super tender cut of meat in the slow cooker, you're going to get some bland, watery mush. You don't want to do it. Do not, in a slow cooker recipe, substitute an expensive and tender cut, thinking you will get a better result. You will not. But if you cook something tough and bony in your slow cooker, you're going to get tender meat that is absolutely bursting with flavor. And you can also, of course, use a Dutch oven to pot roast some meat. You can even do the long slow cooking in a big heavy skillet if the cut of meat fits in the skillet and you have a tight fitting lid. Now, you won't want to leave things for the length of time you would in a slow cooker in either the Dutch oven or the skillet. But you can do this process. It is also nice to know that a great thing about these tough cuts of meat is that they are loaded with gelatin. That's what the connective tissue is made of, is gelatin, also known as collagen. And that gelatin is very, very nutritious stuff. Those of you who read my blog at holdthetoast.com know that I take plain gelatin, the powder, as a supplement every day and have found that it does terrific things for my health. It's also great for your hair, your nails, your skin. It's good for your digestion. Gelatin is one of the main reasons why traditional homemade soups made from boiling up bones are so healing. Now, there's another thing that lends flavor to meat and lowers its price, and that is fat. There is a premium now on very lean cuts of meat because so many people are terrified of fat. Well, since low carbers generally don't worry about fat, we can take advantage of that fat phobia by snapping up the cuts of meat that most people perceive as unhealthy. And fat, again, makes your meat very, very flavorful. I often buy pork shoulder steaks for $1.49 a pound. They sometimes even drop under $1 a pound because pork shoulder steaks are fatty, and that's why I love them. Also, that whole pork shoulder from which those steaks are originally cut, often called a picnic shoulder, another cheap cut, I often get that for less than $1 a pound. So when your budget is tight, just remember, your body doesn't care if it gets its protein from filet mignon or from chuck roast. It doesn't care if it gets it from boneless, skinless chicken breast or from turkey drumsticks and pork neck bones. Take advantage of those cuts that other people don't want to use because they're bony, because they're tough, because they're high in fat, and get some wildly flavorful and super nutritious budget meals. Okay, let's move on to low-carb voices. This is when we share stuff we've gotten from you, our listeners and our readers. And our question on the last show was, what's your biggest challenge to staying with your low-carb program? Well, we didn't get any calls on the voicemail, and I'm guessing that's because we're just starting out and we don't have as many listeners as we're going to have one of these days. Please tell your friends about the show, by the way. But I did get responses to the question about the low-carb challenges through Dana Carpenter's Hold the Toast Press Facebook page, which I'd love you all to sign up for. and I'll share some of those with you. Pete O'Neill wrote in and said his biggest challenge is not journaling like he should, and also thinking this one little bite will not hurt. He says, I lose sight of the end goal too quickly. First of all, Pete, about that end goal, there is no finish line. You have to all get it through your heads that there is no finish line. This has to be the way you're eating for the rest of your lives. It's not just a case of you lose 20 pounds or 30 pounds or whatever and then can go back to eating junk. You can't. You can't. If carbs are your problem, they are going to be your problem today and tomorrow and next week and next month and next year, yay, unto eternity. So, yes, you can have a goal weight, but there shouldn't be a goal of someday I'll be able to stop doing this, because you can't. You just need to learn to make it the most comfortable diet you can. And personally, I love it. Now, I'm not, Pete, I have to say, I'm not as good as I could be about keeping track either. And I do agree that when I write down what I eat, I do tend to lose weight. I often have used Fit Day for this. And keeping track, just, even if you're not keeping track with the idea of, I'm not going to go above 20 grams of carbohydrate, or I'm not going to go above 2,000 calories and 30 grams of carbohydrate or whatever. If you just keep track, it's a powerful tool. Awareness is a powerful tool. Science teaches us that observation changes the observed. So I do think that having some kind of software to use, and Fit Day is free, it's fitday.com. There are also apps you can put in your iPhone or your PDA, your BlackBerry, whatever, that will keep track of everything for you. And I think that's a useful tool. And making it easy to keep track, I think, really helps people to stay with keeping things on track. You know, keep making it easy to record stuff, I think, helps people stay on track with paying attention to what they eat. As for the first bite, oh boy, you are so right. I have heard from so many people who have told me that they did really well on low carb, but then the beginning of the end was the this one bite won't hurt, often combined with, oh, but it's the holidays, or oh, but it's my birthday, or whatever. I think there are three things that really help with this. And by the way, I'm not 100% against indulgences. Once every two or three years, I eat half a sugar-sweetened dessert, and that nice boy I married eats the other half, that kind of thing. But I do think you have to know yourself really well and know that you will go right back on your program the next day. And if you can't do that, you just can't. You can't have that first bite. And I think there are three things that help the most in resisting that first bite. First of all, make sure you're not starving whenever you're going to be out of control of your food, if you're going to a party, if you're going to a conference, anything like that. Be sure you're not hungry when you leave the house. And especially eat your big protein and fat-rich breakfast. This really, really will help your willpower for the rest of the day. There's scientific evidence to that effect. It also helps to have a low-carb friendly snack on hand in your pocket, in your purse, in your briefcase, if you're going to be out of the house for a long time. I always carry food with me when I fly because I never know if I'm going to be able to get something healthful when I'm hungry. Although I have to say that you can generally find some kind of main dish salad at an airport. But having a packet of smoked almonds, a couple of individually wrapped cheese sticks, even a low-carb protein bar with you really helps shore up the willpower. The third thing is to eat your low-carb treats. My readers know that I eat sugar-free chocolate every day. I eat chocolate. People sometimes say to me, oh, I could never give up chocolate. I didn't give up chocolate. I eat chocolate every day. I just eat sugar-free chocolate. I could walk past the chocolate cake, which smelled great, by the way, at the wedding I went to last weekend. I just walked on by. I didn't even consider trying it because I had already had chocolate that morning, and I knew I could have more later when I got home if I wanted it. So that was really useful. Always giving yourself not huge quantities of low-carb treats. They shouldn't be the main focus of your diet, but letting yourself have some low-carb treats really helps. Now, Vivian Hart wrote that her biggest challenge is no bread, and she added, I am a good cook, but nothing low-carb breadish is the same, and I can't buy any low-carb versions in Canada. And Nicola Livingston says her biggest challenge is the smell of freshly baked bread and the fact that she loves making it. The bread machine now only comes out to make challah for Friday nights when we have guests, and for each loaf I make several tiny wee rolls for when it's just the two of us at home. Now, Vivian and Nicola, you both need good low-carb bread recipes, although, Vivian, you sound like you've tried some. You can make low-carb bread. No, it's not exactly the same. On the other hand, it is my observation that different does not necessarily mean worse, and that all tastes are an acquired taste. It is also my observation that low-carb bread is almost universally better toasted. It loses some of that elastic quality that comes from having a lot of gluten in it. I don't much eat low-carb bread anymore or make low-carb bread anymore because I've come to suspect that wheat and gluten aren't really great for anybody. But I do have low-carb bread in my freezer. Vivian, you might see if you can order over the border from Natural Ovens of Manitowoc, which has a wonderful carb-conscious bread, or from Julian Bakery. They also have a good low-carb bread. See if you can order by mail. I don't know what the laws are regarding that kind of thing crossing the border, but it's worth finding out. There are low-carb bread recipes in a number of my books. All of them are for bread machine use. If you don't have a bread machine, I see them at yard sales and thrift shops all the time for $10. You do not have to shell out a bunch of money for a bread machine. And by the way, you can probably get a lot of other low-carb bread recipes online. I mean, free recipes are all over online. You also, Vivian, might look at the fiber-enriched or light breads at your grocery store, because often these come in at 5 or 6 grams of usable carb per slice once you've subtracted the fiber grams from the total carbohydrate grams. You often find that these are only 5 or 6 grams per slice, even though they're not labeled low carb. And I wouldn't recommend that you eat a ton of this stuff, but it would let you have a little bread now and then. We've got more reader challenges, listener challenges. I will post them on the show page at danaslowcarbforlife.com. And if you'd like to share your biggest low-carb challenge, we'd still love to hear about this from you. Call 412-385-DANA. That's 412-385-3262. And let us know. Also, if you have an answer to anybody's reader challenge or listener challenge, we'd love to hear from you also on the show page. Because we do blog there and you can respond. This week's question for Low Carb Voices is, what's your favorite low-carb convenience food? It could be something prepared, like a rotisserie chicken you pick up at the grocery store or the new KFC tender roast chicken. Or it could be something you can make quickly, like an omelet or a smoothie. But we want to know, what food do you turn to when you and maybe your family too are hungry and short on time? So once again, please call 412-385-DANA, 412-385-3262, and let us know what's your favorite low-carb convenience food. Okay, time for our interview. It's time to hear from Adele Hite. This interview ended up running twice as long as I had initially planned, so we're going to play half today, and you'll just have to come back next week to hear the rest. The first time I went on the low-carb cruise with Jimmy Moore and the rest of the low-carb mafia, I met Adele Hite, who was at the time patient educator for Dr. Eric Westman, who is one of America's top clinical researchers of low-carbohydrate diets. I mentioned him on the podcast last week. He's at Duke University. Now, I'd had contact with Adele before because she contributed the shrimp and cheese grits recipe for 500 low-carb recipes. Meeting her in person, I discovered she's smart and funny and super high energy, and that's the low-carb working, of course, the super high energy part, and we became pals instantly. Now, since then, Adele has gone back to school to get her degrees in. Adele, you want to explain this?
Yes, and hi, Dana. I'm happy to be here. I was so inspired by my work in the clinic that at the ripe old age of 45, I decided to go back and work on my master's in public health and become a registered dietitian. And I also was accepted to the PhD program in nutritional epidemiology.
Not too ambitious, are we?
Somebody's got to get out there and fix the situation.
So, well, anyway, Adele obviously herself is low carb. She went low carb with terrific results after she saw what was happening with Dr. Westman's patients. And she's totally hip to low carb nutrition, which is an interesting place to be when you're studying nutrition and dietetics with people who are still stuck in the low fat, low whole grain paradigm. So I knew everybody would be interested in Adele's story, both about working with Dr. Westman and of the journey through conservative nutrition land. So Adele, you worked with Dr. Westman.
Yes.
And, You were already low carb when you started working with him?
So I had lost or was losing weight on a low carb diet about 11 years ago. So before you were even online, I learned a lot of my low carb information from weightlifting sites because that's all that was out there at the time. And Dr. Westman happened to be on the same PTA board that I was on. And we had a mutual friend who said, you know, that crazy diet that you're on, Adele, well, Eric is studying that diet. So I cornered him by the teacher mailboxes one day and asked him if I was killing myself by using this diet because I really loved it. I was losing weight. I felt great. I was gaining muscle, had all this energy, sleeping great. I mean, I just thought it was the best thing. And the food was delicious. And I wasn't hungry and cranky and tired like I was for my 16 years on a low-fat vegetarian diet. And he said, as a matter of fact, we're finding that there's really good health results with this diet. We just have the preliminary results in at this point. But it looks like people are doing really well with regards to their overall health. I was thrilled to hear that.
It is fascinating the way we doubt our own experience of our own body, that you had this dramatic improvement in your health and yet you were still worried. And I've seen that with a lot of people. And and Dr. Atkins used to say that people would say, you know, well, I went off the diet. Well, why'd you go off the diet? Did you feel bad? No, I felt great. Did you hate the food? No, I love the food. You know, how was your health? I never felt better in my life. Lost 45 pounds, you know, great energy. Right. Why'd you quit? Well, everybody told me it was unhealthy.
Yes. When I ran the support group for the clinic, the two primary obstacles that people who came to the support group encountered with regards to sticking on their diet was not willpower, had nothing to do with any unpleasant side effects or symptoms or anything like that. The two main things were that they were told by family and friends and the media that they were killing themselves and they would die of a heart attack any day now. And the other thing was that they lived in such a carb-rich environment that sometimes their choices were really, really limited. And they felt like they couldn't find any foods that didn't already have a ton of sugars and starches pumped into them.
It is true that there are instances in which it's best to either eat well beforehand or bring your own. I was at a wedding yesterday, as I mentioned to you, and I knew it was going to be a small casual wedding and all they were going to do was have cake and punch, not a whole dinner. So I just made sure I had my three sausage patties and my three fried eggs before I went and drank water and made sprightly conversation and had a lovely time. Everybody kept apologizing to me for there not being low carb food, but I was like, look, I ate, I'm used to this. I've been doing this for 15 years. I've figured it out by now.
Right.
I have to address something. Well, no. First, before I get to that, tell me a little something about what you saw with Dr. Westman's patients. What kind of conditions came in and how quickly they changed, that kind of thing.
So, as you said, people doubt their own health. And so I really thought that this was my own crazy metabolism responding to this diet. So when I went to work in the clinic, I was fascinated to see people get better. So quickly. And the patients that we had were coming in, they all, in order for insurance to pay for them to come to the clinic, they had to have what we called comorbidities. So a lot of them had type 2 diabetes or were pre-diabetic, high blood pressure, dyslipidemia, which is typically high triglycerides and low HDL cholesterol.
Sure.
Those were the primary kinds of conditions, but we also saw some other things like reflux and eczema, other sort of more, you know, things that you don't think about as being associated with diet. And the thing that I can say, and we used to sort of pinch ourselves about this, is that if we, the patients who complied with the diet, and not everybody did, and there was a fairly high attrition rate for those reasons I think that that I mentioned, everybody who complied with the diet got better. Now, there were some instances where medications interfered, but for the most part, if you complied with the diet, you got better. Now, that doesn't mean that you lost weight like a crazy person and melted away like a popsicle, but your glucose control got better, your blood pressure got better, HDL went up and triglycerides went down, which is what we want to see. We saw people come off of antidepressants, a lot of people coming off of reflux medication, you know, things that people had just gotten used to living with, irritable bowel syndrome, eczema, sleep apnea, all of these things were getting better. And it sort of makes you sound like a nut when you say, oh, this diet fixes all these things. But it's not that the diet fixes those things. It's that the way that people normally eat, that we think of as the standard American diet, is not a way that nourishes the body. And when you start nourishing the body, the body fixes itself. Yeah. And this is all without a lot of weight loss.
Well, and yes, it has been my experience, you know, talking to a lot of people who have changed their diet, and certainly talking a few people into changing their diet, that bodies desperately want to be well.
Yeah.
And if you will just stop poisoning them and give them what they need, they will change and improve with a rapidity that is startling. And I've seen it over and over. Things like, I had a friend whose triglycerides dropped something like 800, 900 points in 2 weeks. I mean, it's amazing.
The body wants the right food.
Yeah. Yeah. The body really does want to be well. And also the whole thing about, it's crazy to think that all these things can be treated by this one very simple, basic intervention. I forget who wrote about this, but they said, imagine what it would be like if all these years later, we still hadn't discovered that syphilis is caused by a spirochete, by a bacteria, and that we could kill it with antibiotics. What would we be doing for people who had advanced syphilis? Well, we'd be sending them to psychiatrists for their insanity and giving them drugs for their upset mental condition. We'd be giving them salves for their sores on their skin. You know, all these varying things, treating all of the symptoms that crop up from what is really a single underlying disease.
Exactly.
And it's exactly the same thing. Once you remove the underlying stimulus of the disease process, then things can get better. Okay, a little change of subject. Since A New Atkins for a New You came out, I have seen some ugly implications made in the media about Dr. Westman's integrity. I don't mind people thinking that Dr. Westman is wrong, although obviously I disagree with them, and so do you. But the character slurs, the assumption that he is cynical, that he is being paid off. I've seen people say, oh, he's being paid off by the fast food industry, as if the fast food industry didn't make their money on cheap carbs.
Right.
These character slurs bother me a great deal because, as you know, I met Eric Westman on the same cruise where I met you and spent 5 days getting to know him. And he struck me as not only being a very brilliant and very educated man, but also as being as honest and straightforward and sincere a guy as I had ever met in my life. So for people who may have read some of this, could you please speak to Dr. Westman and what kind of a person he is? Because I think that's only fair.
So again, he was, before he was ever Dr. Westman to me, he was Eric the fundraiser at the PTA. So I know him and his family from a long time back, and I don't, you know, he's a Midwesterner. He could not be any more genuine than he is. I think that this actually gets him in trouble in the world of science and academia, because he won't tiptoe around the fact that the diet makes people better in all sorts of ways. And you know, when you take a point of view like that, that goes so far against, you know, the past 30 years of what has really been our fad diet, which is this low fat, wheat and corn and soy based thing, that you sound like an extremist when he's really just trying to correct the pendulum that swung so far in the other direction. His patients love him because he makes them better. So let me tell you about, this is my favorite, patient story. This one lady that we had come in, we weren't sure if she could do the diet because she was so out of it. She couldn't fill out the patient information form. She was not really receptive to the patient education materials that I was telling her about. She just sort of grunted in our general direction. But we started her on the diet. Dr. Westman reduced, she had type 2 diabetes, and he reduced her insulin levels that she was taking. She came in 2 weeks later, and I had to double check the chart to make sure it was the same woman. This woman had come in with a cane that she was leaning heavily on. She was swinging this cane around the waiting room, just and practically jumped out of her chair when she saw me. And I was leading her back to check her in, and she saw Dr. Westman. She threw the cane on the floor of the hallway, ran down the hallway, and just jumped into his arms and gave him a big hug. She said, "Dr. Westman, you fixed me." And it brought tears to both of our eyes. It was just a wonderful moment. She was a different person. She had gotten her life back because he was brave enough to swim against the current and prescribe this diet.
Well, and we have to remember, first of all, the charges, again, that Dr. Westman is somehow working for the fast food or processed food industries is insane, because they don't make their money on meat and eggs. They make their money on cheap processed carbohydrate. I saw coupons in today's Sunday paper, local paper, for Steak and Shake, and they had this thing about, you know, we have X meals, you know, like 14 meals for, or 10 meals or something for $3.99 and under. And one of them was the double cheeseburger with fries. And then they also had the coupons for meals for $4.99, one of which was the double cheeseburger with fries and the Coke. So you're paying the dollar for the sugar water, which cost them what, a nickel?
Right.
That's what they're making money on. And to suggest that somehow pushing a low carbohydrate diet, or pushing is the wrong word, advocating a low carbohydrate diet is playing into the hands of the food processors is just
really doesn't make a lot of logical sense. Since when we look at the food availability data, the food that has become more available in the past 30 years is all processed foods. And the reality of what we saw in the clinic is that when we put people on a no sugar, no starch diet, by virtue of that diet prescription, they shifted their meals towards less processed, less industrialized foods. They were eating foods that didn't come in packages, that didn't come with labels. And patients, so he I think he gets some flack because he, you know, was an author on the Atkins book, and Atkins has this knee-jerk reaction as being this, you know, all about making money. And
why does nobody ever accuse Ornish of being in it for the money?
Right, because he didn't make a lot of money.
That's right. You know, he and Andrew Weil haven't made a ton of money, have they?
Right, and why is that? You have to ask yourself. Well, maybe it's because the diet doesn't work all that well. Well, you know, there is that. So, there is an issue. So Atkins Nutritionals, however, is different from the Atkins Foundation.
Yeah.
And Atkins Foundation does pursue and fund a lot of research, but not just low carb research. I mean, they're very, very open-minded just with nutritional research in general. And again, you know, the folks at Atkins Nutritionals, from what I understand, those folks actually do believe. Now, they're pushing a product. There's no doubt about that. But that product is helpful for some patients. And then we had other patients who couldn't use those products. So Dr. Westman is not pushing those products. He's prescribing a diet that refeeds people, re-nourishes people. People go about putting that diet into practice in different ways because people have different lifestyles. I mean, if you're a stay-at-home mom, you have different flexibility with regards to what you're able to cook than if you're a traveling salesman.
Sure. I on the way back from the wedding yesterday, I stopped and had a cheeseburger at Burger King that I took off the bun and put on a garden salad. And yeah, it was fast food. Guess what? It wasn't bad for me.
See what I mean about Adele? You'll want to listen to the next show to hear about her adventures in nutritional academia. It's interesting stuff. But right now, we're out of time. Please remember to call 412-385-DANA. That's 412-385-3262. And tell us what your favorite low-carb convenience food is. You can also share your low-carb challenges. We're always interested in hearing how we can help. And you can always drop us a line at feedback@danaslowcarbforlife.com. That's feedback@danaslowcarbforlife.com. We want to hear from you. Talk to you next week. This is Dana Carpenter saying thanks for listening. If you like today's show, please leave a review at the iTunes store. You can always leave questions and comments at 412-385-DANA or write us at feedback@danaslowcarbforlife.com. For complete show notes, please visit our site at www.danaslowcarbforlife.com and don't forget to visit the blog at holdthetoast.com. Special thanks to Disc of Light Media and our sponsor, carbsmart.com.